You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
Well, I think we're going to get started. We've got everybody in place. I want to welcome you all to today's panel. I'm Kate Seeley, Senior Vice President of the Middle East Institute, and welcome to today's panel, Advancing the Kerry Peace Process. I myself have just gotten back from a two-week trip to New Zealand, where the Middle East seemed very, very far away, blissfully far away, I might add, and was surprised to return to find that while the conflict has not been resolved, there have been some interesting developments. Apparently, President Obama, after letting Kerry do much of the heavy lifting, has decided to put some skin in the game. This according to White House officials and his interview with journalist Jeffrey Goldberg of Bloomberg in early March, in which he said that time is running out for Israel to make peace. We also heard a rather uncharacteristically positive endorsement of peace from Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu in his recent AIPAC speech, where he noted that many Arab leaders recognize that Israel is not their enemy and that peace with the Palestinians could lead to open, thriving relationships with many Arab countries. And Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas comes to Washington next week to meet with Obama to discuss the peace process in person. Now, granted, none of these amount to much, but they are reminders that we are nearing the target April deadline set by the Kerry team for the two parties to accept a framework agreement that would then lead to more talks about a comprehensive peace settlement. So what do we know about the key elements of this framework agreement from what we've been able to glean from the few leaks, because the details have been carefully guarded by all sides? Is this framework agreement itself a bad sign, an indication that the parties are still so far apart that Secretary Kerry needs to buy more time? If so, how much skin does Obama need to put in the game to get these talks beyond a framework agreement? And if he can't, then what next? Can either Netanyahu or Abbas really deliver peace given the context in which they operate? And finally, how do the Israeli and Palestinian people feel about the current prospects for peace after so many decades of conflict? These are just a few of the questions I hope our distinguished panelists will tackle today, panelists whom I should note have between them decades of experience negotiating over and advising on the peace process. I'm not going to give long introductions. Their full bios are in the handout. But allow me to say just a few words about them in order of appearance. Aaron David Miller is the Vice President for New Initiatives and a distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He also served at the Department of State for more than 25 years, where he served as advisor on the Arab-Israeli negotiations to six secretaries of state. He's written many books on the peace process, including The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. Daniel Levy is the director of the Middle East and North Africa program at the European Council for Foreign Relations. He's also senior research fellow at the New America Foundation and a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. Mr. Levy was a policy advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and a member of the Israeli delegation to the Taba negotiations with the Palestinians in 2001. He also led the Israeli, he was also the lead Israeli drafter, of the Geneva Initiative. Shibli Telhami is the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has served as an advisor on Middle East issues to the U.S. government on many occasions, including acting as senior advisor to President Obama's U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace, George Mitchell, from 2009 to 2011. He's the author of, among other books, The Stakes, America and the Middle East. Before we begin, however, I just want to note that MEI has the honor of hosting these distinguished panelists thanks to the generous contribution and support of the George and Rhonda Salem Family Foundation, which has enabled MEI to program consistently on the Arab-Israeli conflict. Today's panel is the seventh in our series, and we look forward to more panels on this topic in the future thanks to the Salem family. And now I would like to invite Aaron David Miller to the podium, and watch out for the mic. It's a little tricky.
You won't attack me, will you? First of all, Kate, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. And Daniel and Shibley, many times have we conspired and collaborated. I want to make a half dozen observations. I'll be very clear and concise and fairly crisp. My own analysis on these matters since leaving government, it won't surprise you. The word I use is annoyingly negative. My analysis has been annoyingly negative, not for any political, emotional, or reasons driven by career change. Although I do believe where you stand in life has a lot to do with where you sit. Art Hughes will appreciate this. No, it's driven by what I see. And in government, for many reasons, I didn't see what I would argue to you would be clearly or honestly enough about the fate disposition of what I called in my last book, The Much Too Promised Land. Too many illusions with the best of intentions over time can lead in matters of war and peacemaking to bad decisions. Now, we made a lot of good decisions over the course of the last 20-plus years. Most were made during the first Bush administration. We also made a lot of bad decisions. And when the decisions were bad, they were always made, always, irrepressibly so, because we persisted in seeing the world the way we wanted it to be rather than the way it was. Now, I grant you, if you only see the world the way it is, nothing ever changes. There's no question about that. Nothing will change. But if you only see the world the way you want it to be, you will fail every single time. It is the balance between the way the world is on one end and the way you want it to be on the other that provides, I would argue, not just in diplomacy, but in life, marriage, friendship, business. It's the balance. And that is, in essence, what is required. The most judicious and effective American policy always strikes that balance. So, let me make a number of observations. First of all, if you want to learn about the Middle East, you start in the Middle East. If you want to learn about American policy toward the Middle East, you do not start in the Middle East, nor do you start with your own predispositions or prejudices. You start with by analyzing the realities of what Washington can tolerate and what it cannot tolerate. I've been focused very much these days on America. I have a new book coming out called The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. So I'm very focused on presidents. And I will begin a set of observations, and please stop me at eight to 9 minutes, otherwise I'll run on interminably. I start with the proposition that government is about choosing. It has always been about choosing. It depends on what a president cares about and what a president doesn't care about. And when it comes to the Arab-Israeli issue, if a president cares and there is the prospects and possibility for ownership in the region among the parties themselves, then, in fact, the combination of these two vectors can, in fact, create change. I would argue that every breakthrough in this region, and there have only been three, arguably four, over the course of a 60-year period, resulted from this confluence. If the parties don't own this, I don't care what the president wants. And if the president doesn't own it, it may not matter what the parties want. And I submit to you that as Barack Obama looks at the Middle East for the remainder of his presidency, he's much more focused on the middle class than he is on the Middle East. His legacy over the last, and it explains a lot about his policies. I'm not being critical here, by the way. I'm just reporting for the moment. His risk aversion, and that is how I would explain it, his risk aversion is driven by a set of priorities that are domestic-based. Unless you understand this, I think it's hard to analyze American policy. We're emerging from the two longest wars in American history, a decade where the standard for victory was never could we win, but when could we leave? And the price that we've paid in Iraq and Afghanistan, given what we have gotten back, is a prohibitive one. 6,000 American dead, trillions expended, and most of our credibility in shatters. And what do we have to show for it? Second, our own house is not in good shape. I call them the six deadly D's: debt, dysfunctional politics, deficit, decaying infrastructure, a deteriorating educational system, and dependence on hydrocarbons. These are slow bleeds. They're not the kind of crises that make great presidents, but they're sapping the national strength anyway. So the last thing this president needs is an extraneous foreign adventure, whether it's in Syria, Ukraine, or in Iran. And in Iran, it explains his risk readiness. His objective is to prevent an Israeli strike, to make an American military action unnecessary, and ultimately to get an agreement that will not allow his predecessors, or his successors, and his critics to argue that he allowed the Iranians to cross the threshold with respect to either a putative nuclear weapons capacity or the weapon itself. And he's risk-ready when it comes to defending the United States with respect to counterterrorism. He has emerged to be a much more intensive, disciplined, and much more, actually, I would say, less ideological version of his predecessor. Certainly in the use of predator drones, keeping Guantanamo open, finding the right balance, but how to preserve American security interests, and he's erred clearly on the side of preserving those interests when it comes to trying to figure out what to do about the NSA, metadata dragnet collection effort. All of these things make him risk-averse in the counterterrorism issue, but very risk-ready, but very risk-averse in the Middle East. So John Kerry has limitations in terms of his own diplomacy. This is not the John Kerry show. Ultimately, so far it has been Kerry's relentlessness, in my judgment, that has got the Israelis and Palestinians as far as they have gone in this process. It will be Obama, however, who has set the parameters already and who will have to make a decision about what to do in the next phase of these negotiations. Second, I've been predicting for months now that Kerry would come up with a piece of paper. It will not be a framework agreement. It will not be a bilateral agreement. Kerry goes to great lengths to call it an agreed framework. Framework agreement, agreed framework, to guide the negotiations. That's what it is. It's a piece of paper that essentially will be comprised of American ideas and positions, taking into account where the parties differ and where their positions converge. It will allow a certain amount of dissent, assuming it materializes, asterisks, encumbrances, reservations. It is designed, we would call it in the old days, an I's and P's paper, designed to identify where the gaps remain and to see if you can get the parties on the six core issues that drive the conflict more or less operating in the same universe, so that when the real negotiations begin, it's much like the Iranian interim agreement. This is merely a phase. The tough decisions on Iran and the peace process will come not now. They will come toward the end of this year, I would argue, after the midterms or in 2015. That is when these two interim processes will reach some sort of, I won't say solutions because I don't believe in solutions. I believe in outcomes. And they don't necessarily have to be bad outcomes. But if you're looking for a comprehensive agreement, look somewhere else, which brings me to my third point. And I want to be unmistakably clear about this, because I do not want to be misquoted. I do not want to be characterized any more than I am as someone who has either succumbed to despair or cynicism. That is not where I am. I am not cynical. I have two children. They're 33 and 31. I do not have the right to say never to them on the Arab-Israeli issue. I spent too many years of my life to give up on this. But I also will not engage in illusions. So I say for my third point this to you. There is, you can accept it, you can reject it, you can do whatever you want with it, but it is based on what I see. There is no, and I choose my words very carefully, there is no conflict-ending agreement, available right now to Israelis and Palestinians. And let me tell you what I mean by that. I mean that an Israeli prime minister will stand in the Knesset and a Palestinian president in the Palestinian Legislative Council and say the following: we may not have peace and reconciliation, but on the six core issues that drive our conflict, there are no more claims to be adjudicated, no more irredented to be pursued. Our conflict is done. It is over. It is almost unimaginable to me fantastical, really, that with these two leaders and the current state of this region, that I could hear such a statement by either of them anytime soon. That does not mean it cannot happen. That does not mean there's some metaphysical or magical reason why the Israelis and the Palestinians cannot find a way to proceed, to have a conflict ending agreement, but it takes a degree of determination, will, courage, and a administration in Washington that is prepared to do its part in probably the most complicated and heroic piece of the Arab-Israeli peace process since its inception. And we trivialize the degree of difficulty in this process by saying, well, we know where it's going to end. Everybody knows what the solution is. Frankly, everyone has known since we left Camp David in July of 2000, which is almost 14 years ago. Hard to believe. 13 days at Camp David, 14 years ago. Of course everybody knows what the solution is, but that's not the issue. You need will and you need skill. And the will and the skill have to be evident on the Israeli side, the Palestinian side, and in Washington. And frankly, I do not see enough will and skill evident anywhere to produce what I'm describing. Now, with sufficient motivation, circumstance, it's perhaps possible to get an outcome that will allow the April deadline to be extended in a way that isn't filled with recrimination, catastrophe, or the collapse of the process. That is, in fact, what I'm predicting, either through a mix of a paper, and keep in mind, we're talking here about a paper world. This is the world of what we call the FAPS, the Framework Agreement on Permanent Status. And this is only the first stage. What you need to produce is what we used to call the CAPS, the Comprehensive Agreement on Permanent Status, the document that actually closes the ambiguities, resolves the issues, and creates a baseline so that you can then go to the next phase where paper coincides with reality, implementation, which raises a number of issues of considerable magnitude, which cannot be addressed now. I'm not suggesting they can. One final point, and I'll close on as optimistic a note as I can I manage. You need, I do not believe we've had a serious foreign policy in this country since Bush 41 and James Baker. I say that having worked for five of Baker's successors. They were all good people, all talented in their own way. But on this particular issue, the capacity to apply enough honey and vinegar simultaneously to create the kind of environment you need to actually close this issue, we're nowhere close to that. And I don't trivialize or want to create any disrespect for John Kerry or the president. But what it's going to require to close this conflict down, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, border security, Jerusalem, recognition of Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people, finality of claims and security, what it's going to take to close those six issues down is a degree of will we haven't seen and a degree of skill. Jack Kennedy, the first and last president ever to have an emotional impact on me, said the following about himself. He described himself as an idealist without illusion. If you listen to nothing else here today from me, listen to that, because that's where we need to be. Idealism without illusion, never giving up on the prospects that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict can be resolved. But as we try to resolve it, we really have to do a better job of keeping our eyes wide open. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Kate, and yeah, lower it quite a lot. Thanks very much, Kate, and the Middle East Institute for hosting us, and it's good to be on a panel with Shibley and Aaron, and you mentioned this was the seventh in the series of the Salem family lectures. I'm sure that what Aaron says and I said, and I imagine what Shibley might say, will leave a distinct sense that there'll be time for plenty more lecture series on this. What I wanted to briefly do is actually try and cover three things. One is the context in which this current Kerry-led effort is taking place. Secondly, some of what I consider to be the problems with the effort. And finally, just briefly to look at some of the options going forward. And I want to pick up where Aaron left off and honey and vinegar. And I don't think one can understand, let alone critique, what is being attempted without understanding that context. And for me, that context consists of maybe four or five things. And I think the most important one, because we're here, is just to remember the basics of what we are talking about. And I think this sense of a peace process with Israelis and Palestinians, and you've got an Israeli leader and a Palestinian leader, and they have their respective governments, creates a very false sense of symmetry. This is an occupation. It's an occupying power and an occupied people. The occupying power is a very reluctant deoccupier at best. And sometimes there may be maybe attempts to massage that very basic reality. But the reality is that when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu landed here a few days ago and said, it takes three to tango. This was his latest. He challenges Aaron in the science soundbite the department. When he says it takes three to tango, and we only have two, and the Palestinians need to show up for the dance. At a very basic level, it really doesn't. This could be done in a solo act. Because there's a basic act of deoccupation. And essentially, with this conflict, everything else is secondary to that. What I want to say about the Kerry effort is, in terms of the context, is first of all, you do not have an American ability or willingness, and those are the same thing at the end of the day, to use the prospective leverage it has with that reluctant deoccupier. I take that as a given. I take it as a given that leverage possibly exists. It will not be exerted. Number one. Number two, there is no other real leverage that has been created by the Palestinians. It is not, and one has to be fair to the policy that is run out of Washington, it is not Washington that is preventing the Palestinians from seeking to acquire some leverage in this conflict, from seeking to address the asymmetry. It would be difficult. There is a golden cage of a Palestinian authority that has been established over a course of 20 plus years. But the Palestinians themselves are locked into a strategic cul-de-sac. And it is not for Washington to negotiate the Palestinians' way out of the strategic cul-de-sac that they are in. If they choose to try and assert leverage, if they choose to try and pursue a non-Washington-centric approach, if they choose to try to mobilize their own people, region, sympathizers, etc., that may change the asymmetry. They have chosen not to do that. Even all the talk of BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, this is not a PLO-driven thing. It is a thing that the PLO has a very ambivalent relationship towards. For all the talk of, including by the leadership here and by the centrist camp in Israel, for all the talk of the time on two states will elapse, this Rubicon will be crossed, there's no alternative narrative that the Palestinian leadership are embracing or pushing. Thirdly, there is very limited pressure within Israel to do anything serious, to move, as Aaron said, from paper to practice. Very little pressure inside Israel. And there's no real political alternative in Israel to Prime Minister Netanyahu. Now that gives the Americans very limited tools to work with. Now sometimes an American attempt to intervene, to impact, to influence someone else's politics can be clumsy and club-footed and not very effective, and sometimes it can actually make quite significant change. And there have been both examples in the history of efforts with Israel. And in 92 on Rabin Shamir, in 99 with Barack Netanyahu Clinton, I actually think there was an Israeli political reality to relate to where an alternative existed. Today, that alternative does not seem to exist. The Labour leader, Yitzhak Budzhi Herzog, is seen as an alternative to the far-right leader, Bennett, not as an alternative to Bibi. And that's a significant thing. Finally, on this context, the American understanding of the conflict is excessively mediated through a narrative that is quite deeply rooted here, which gets Zionism, and it gets the gamut of Israeli concerns, and it identifies instinctively with Israeli narratives, whether they be more or less liberal. Palestinian narratives are, especially in this city, I think it's less true of America beyond Washington, D.C., but I think Palestinian narratives are insufficiently communicated here and understood here. So the default American position is to put its thumb down on the side of the scales, which exacerbates an existing asymmetry rather than redressing that. And why I wanted to mention that background is I think that doesn't leave Secretary Kerry very much to work with, which is why I think, I don't want to get into this debate, is the president invested in this or not? I think it would be a hard job to do to make the case that you can get a win on this issue, which means that the dogged determination of a Secretary of State to not allow this to slip off the agenda is one of the few things he can bring to the table. And I give him some credit for that. If you're saying, Mr. Prime Minister, we really need to talk on some of these issues, and the Prime Minister says, great, I'm free in 3 weeks from now in Jerusalem, Mr. Secretary. He said, well, funnily enough, I'm in Rome tomorrow. It's a hop, skip and a jump away from you. Let's meet for dinner. You can't say, Mr. Secretary, sorry. You know, Sarah's prepared some fantastic gefilte fish another time. So I think the dogged determination of the Secretary of State is what is moving this along, which is significant, but almost certainly not enough. Secondly, to briefly talk through what I consider to be some of the problems with the approach that has been taken. The first problem is the following. I assume, and whether it's correct or not, let's just put this assumption out there for the next couple of minutes. I assume that this is not just about saying to the region, to the world, to themselves, hey, we're seriously trying to do something on Israel-Palestine. We know it can't achieve anything, but let's at least maintain the sense that we're doing something, or that this is just an attempt to buy time, to buy quiet. It's much easier to manage this issue if you're in a peace process than if you're not. If you're not in a peace process, the Palestinians might go to the UN, all kinds of things might happen. So it's easier to manage the relationship with Israel if there's a peace process going on. But I assume that there is actually an attempt to get from the paper world to the real world, as Aaron said, certainly on the part of the Secretary of State. My assumption is that he is working according to the following theory. If I can neutralize the Israeli Prime Minister's ability to say, I can't do this because of security, and I can't do this until they recognize a Jewish state. If I can get the Palestinians on board on those two issues, then Prime Minister Netanyahu cannot but seriously address territory. He will have to address these other issues. And I think that's a fundamental misreading of Israel and of the Israeli Prime Minister and of how this works, which is why I think in its current iteration, this can't go very far. Because I think the American sense would be to say, look what we're delivering. This is more demanding on the Palestinians and less demanding on you than Clinton in December of 2000, the Clinton parameters, way more so than the Olmert Abbas talks from a few years ago. So if we put something so tempting, of course the Israeli reaction will be, wow, this is a much better deal. We better grab it while we can. The Israeli way of interpreting this, of the current Israeli leadership, is to say, wow, 14 years after Clinton and 6 years after Olmert Abbas, the Americans have moved further in our direction. We built more settlements, we kept saying no, and everyone realigned their own reality to accord with the reality we created on the ground. What is the lesson? We keep going. If we keep defying, keep building, then next time the changes to the border will be even greater. Jerusalem will be even more compromising for the Palestinians. Maybe they'll recognize a greater Jewish commonwealth, not just a Jewish state. Our right to colonize the moon. I don't know. But the logic, it's a disconnect. It's a logical disconnect that I think undermines this. I think the other American premise would be that if this comes to a moment of decision and Netanyahu loses his coalition and has to reshape his coalition, then there's no going back. If the right breaks away and Netanyahu goes into coalition and replaces the far right with some centrists, then there will be an inexorable dynamic propelling the Prime Minister forward. And again, I think it's a misreading, because I think that the reality is that Netanyahu, A, may well be asked not to make a choice that entails losing his coalition. I actually think the parameters could be so, or the agree framework thing could be so user-friendly and unproblematic for an Israeli prime minister to spin that the coalition will stay as it is. But even if the coalition breaks, Netanyahu can form a new government and do nothing and turn round to the world and say, look what happened. I'm the one who paid the big political price. The next months have to be about clarifying that the Palestinians really mean it on Jewish state. Nothing more can be expected of me now. When Sharon wanted to do something major, first he decided he was going to leave Gaza, then he reshaped Israeli politics. Here, the opposite will be happening. Bibi won't be asked to do anything decisive. He will reshape Israeli politics and continue as is. And here, details matter. And so my second concern with the current thing is what the actual parameters will be. I won't go into this in detail. But I am concerned that on every issue, this will go further in indulging unreasonable Israeli positions than the Clinton parameters did in December 2000. Now, I frame it that way because I think if there's ever going to be a two-state outcome, it is going to have to be sustainable. It will have to do just enough to maintain a sense of dignity on both sides, to address both sides' needs, or this will fall apart. On land, if we mention 67, mention land swaps, but do not place a ceiling on the land swaps, do not place a maximum land swap. Now, Clinton parameters, I think, got that wrong. 6% is an awful lot. Olmert Abbas in their talks spoke of a lower number. But if this does not place any ceiling, and if this does not stipulate that the land swaps have to be equal, or another word that means the same, then I don't think using the word 67 achieves anything. I don't think it becomes a moment of choice, especially if the language would recognize changes on the ground. And I could go through Jerusalem, Jewish state, refugees, security, and I think on every single measure, I won't go into detail now, But on every single measure, I think this will be more indulging of those unreasonable positions than even the Clinton parameters were. And I feel, I know some interpreted Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech at the APAC conference as somehow conducive to preparing Israeli public opinion for forward movement. I read it at the opposite. I thought this was a very belligerent speech. And I think this Jewish state issue, which again I'm happy to go into detail, but I won't now. This Jewish state issue is being raised to the level of poking the Palestinians in the eye with it in a way that is intentionally making it increasingly impossible for Abbas to accept, even if there was an ability to do that in some way at some stage. He is essentially being asked, without getting anything, to accept past Palestinian dispossession and accept current and future Palestinian discrimination of Palestinians inside Israel. And if anyone's following the debates taking place in the Knesset today, see just what dangerous developments are going on in that respect. Thirdly, the approach to Palestinians. I just don't think anything's changed. Gaza is still ignored. Internal Palestinian division is still ignored. By the way, not that that's driven by the Palestinians and the region themselves, but it's still being ignored. And there's this continued effort to take an emaciated Palestinian leadership and grind them further. Now, what use someone trying to get an agreement that goes from paper to reality, what use someone who's trying to do that would have with a Palestinian leadership that is further discredited in the eyes of its own people, I struggle to understand. So let me finally, briefly, touch on what the options might be. And as I see it, there are maybe three of those. Number one, go for a short-term, dramatic roll of the dice. Now, I don't think that's going to be done, and I think there are very good reasons why that won't be done, and I think I outlined them. What it would look like would be to put a far clearer choice on the table in this framework. For the Americans to put forward a position that says to continue these talks for 9 months, there has to be clarity that both parties are accepting ABC. And ABC is very different to the parameters that I just outlined, especially when it comes to 67. Say 67 with minor equal land swaps. Boom. That's the decisive one. Now, I'd have a hard time making a compelling case for doing that, because what that rests on is that somehow this will play out in Israeli politics and throw up a new reality where this alternative, where either Netanyahu says, oh my God, I have to make my moment of choice now, or an alternative vector emerges, which we are not seeing today. So I don't think that's going to happen, and I can understand why. Second option. Look at this as a 3-year plan, not a 3-week plan or a 6-week plan through to the end of April. And don't get the framework agreement wrong now. I would actually say better to continue the talks with no framework than with the kind of framework that is being discussed or at least leaked about. I have some thoughts on this. I won't go into them. But I think you could maybe turn around, and I think the Palestinians, it would be a hard sell, but I think it's doable. Turn around and try and say to both parties, you didn't like what was in this framework? Okay. My ask is continue negotiating then without a framework. And what I would link that to is Iran. Get a win on Iran as the US. Get the deal done with Iran and then circle back to this and see how it has impacted, especially the Netanyahu dynamic. The third option is acknowledge that the conditions are not ripe, that this is not going to be a game-changing presidency on this issue. But it might be an I-told-you-so presidency. And sometimes I wonder if that's not what's really going on, not with Secretary Kerry, but perhaps with President Obama. Because he seems to be saying, Israel, as I see it, we'll have your back for the indefinite future, whatever you do. Really, whatever you do. All I can tell you is, even our best efforts will not convince the rest of the world under these circumstances. And if the conditions are not ripe, then it's probably worth paying more attention to what's going on in Area C, what the president himself described as aggressive settlement expansion during negotiations. Human rights, international law, international humanitarian law, bringing that discourse more into how one treats an issue that you're not going to resolve in the short term. I spoke for too long, but thank you.
Thanks very much. It's always a pleasure to be at the Middle East Institute and participate in the panel. Aaron and Daniel covered a lot of material, so I'd like to just narrow my focus of my presentation. I'll start with Aaron's early observation, which obviously projected pervasive pessimism, which I think is doesn't come as a surprise to most people. But Aaron did talk about a balance between the world the way it is and the way it ought to be, and I think it was more focused on the way the world is, without kind of a little bit of a focus on, so what's driving this seeming opportunity for the administration forward. I'd like to focus on that a little bit. But before I do that, I'd like to add more to the pessimism. And that is, you know, obviously that's where we all are. That's what the assessment is. And I want to talk about the consequences of that. But to give you a flavor of it, start with the strategic picture. Whatever it is that the administration does, if it does put a plan on the table, I think it's unlikely it'll get Palestinian support without broader Arab support. Because it's going to be controversial no matter what you do. The Palestinians will need broad Arab support. In this environment, that means at least getting the support of Saudi Arabia and Egypt, two countries that are not particularly happy to cooperate with the U.S. right now. And they will need at least some quartet cover, if not more international cover. It's very hard to see Russia being anxious to cooperate right now. And if you want to put it in terms of the administration's own priority, I think that their priority is clear in the Middle East, Iran, more than the Israel-Palestine question, in large part because this is the only issue that can drag this administration into a war it doesn't want before it leaves office. The only issue. Because if diplomacy fails, the pressure on this president to do something is going to increase. It's going to be very hard to do it. So you can add more to it. And then add the public perception in the region. In my poll among Israelis and Palestinians in December, 4% of Israelis and 11% of Palestinians said that there is a chance this diplomacy could succeed. 4% and 11% said there's a chance. Half said it's too late for the two-state solution. It'll never happen, period. So, yes, it's amazing odds, a lot of pessimism. And that pessimism itself translates into assessment for the negotiators themselves. If I'm a negotiator and I'm looking at the odds, I'm saying, what's the chance that these negotiators could succeed? Even if I'm an optimist, I'm going to go more than the 4%, the 11%. I'm going to say, okay, 30%. I'm saying there will be 70% chance of failure. If there's going to be 70% chance of failure, why would I want to do any compromise on any issue knowing that I'm going to get stuck at the end of being blamed for something that's not going to work? In fact, some of that kind of reflection is evident in the polling of Israeli and Palestinian public, and it shows you the problems, but it also shows you the promise of why we still need to focus a little bit more on what could be done, not just on what couldn't be done. And if you look at public opinion, it's really very telling. When we present to Israelis and Palestinians both issue-by-issue proposals, would you accept compromise on the right of return, on Jerusalem, on the Jewishness of Israel, on borders? Both people are not prepared to compromise on those issues, issue by issue. When you put forth a proposal to them that says, okay, your negotiators could only come up with this, this is it. All the issues are on the table. This is what you have. This is all that they've gotten. And list all the compromises in that proposal, as we did in December. Among Israelis and Palestinians, we had 54% of Israelis say, well, they'll accept it. And we had 41% of Palestinians say they'll accept it. And then if you add to them a follow-up question, what if the other side also accepted this proposal, Then you go up to 60% of the public actually saying yes to the proposal on both sides. Because part of, when you ask the question, so what is going on here, why is it that the public suddenly is more positive, there are two elements going on. One element is that issue by issue negotiation is idiotic, totally idiotic, because there is no one who's going to give up on a core issue without knowing what they're going to get on the other issues, because it's a trade-off. There's linkage. There's no such thing as issue by issue negotiations on such painful issues. So until they know what else they're getting, they're not going to compromise. There's a balance, a balancing act. That's number one. Number two, much of the assessment is based on this, the negativity, meaning they assess that the chance is bad. In large part, they assess that the chance is small because they think the other side will just pocket the concessions and then leave them hanging dry. So when you put what if they accept, the chances go up dramatically. So it is part of, increasing the chance. So one of the problems for this administration from day one has been that while they benefited from the low expectations, saying, what's there to lose, right? I mean, basically, everybody thinks we're not going to succeed, so what price are we paying? The problem is when the expectations are so low, it's very hard to get any concessions. So at some point, if you really get serious, you have to start kind of increasing the perception that that negotiation can succeed or will succeed. They haven't done that enough. But that's obviously tied much more to assessment of reality than to something that administration can create. The consequence of this is that the administration itself, I think correctly, doesn't see public opinion as the barrier to an agreement. They basically think that if the Israeli government, for one thing, accepts the agreement, they're likely to get Israeli public support. If the Palestinian Authority accepts it with backing from the Arab states, Palestinian public opinion are likely to support it. So the focus isn't so much on public opinion in the context of negotiations. But what happened in the process of this negotiation is as they work with the Israeli government, I think the administration reached two conclusions. One conclusion is they cannot get around the Israeli government. What does that mean? That yes, the Israeli public in theory can support it, but they're divided enough that if they put a plan and the Israeli government reject it, it's not likely the public is going to push the Israeli government to accept it. So they're starting with the assumption that there is no way you can get around the Israeli government. When they look at the Israeli government, they're starting with the assumption that some part of the Israeli government are hopeless, they will never accept. And that led them to focus specifically on one man, and that is the Prime Minister of Israel. And so the theory behind the entire negotiation rests on the assumption that they can sway this one man, Benjamin Netanyahu, to accept what it is that they're going to put on the table. And that if he does, then he can create a coalition that will be supportive, and then he'll get the public support. And I urge you, for those of you who haven't read the president's interview with Jeffrey Goldberg, to go read it, because that's very clear. That's exactly his focus on that one man, but it's very obvious in the administration strategy. It's a one-man strategy. Now, there are two things that you could draw from that. One thing is that because Netanyahu is so central to their strategy, if he says no, they don't have a plan, then obviously that diminishes the extent to which they're going to be responsive to the Palestinians. And the fear here is that in the attempt to get Netanyahu to accept to what it is they're going to put on the table, then they will have elements that they really can't take the Palestinians for granted on. And I compare that. I know Aaron was involved in these negotiations, so was Daniel Levy back in 2000. And I've warned the administration multiple times before Camp David that they're underestimating the extent to which the Palestinians are committed to Jerusalem. I wrote about it a week before, and I went to the White House, talked about it, that this is they're not understanding how important the Jerusalem issue is to the Palestinians. It could fail over this issue. It failed over this issue. Obviously, there were many other reasons. But I think there is some things here that you can't take for granted. These are critical issues to both people, and there is the fear that it might not work quite that well, and that's something that I worry about. Now, let me end with just one thought, and then I will talk about what if the administration fails. If you look at the Palestinian and Israeli public opinion, and even American public opinion, one theme that drives the preparedness of the public to accept something put on the table if their leaders accept it. I already talked about two dynamics, but there's one broader issue, and that is that even those who don't like a compromise agreement on two states, when you ask them what is likely to happen if two states are no longer possible, both Israelis and Palestinians, you ask them what would happen if two states is no longer possible, what do you think would happen? Give them every conceivable scenario, including one state with equal citizenship. Overwhelmingly, both parties say violence for years to come or status quo. Including among Palestinians, no one says then it'll lead to one state with equal citizenship. So the fact that the alternatives are worse, the fact that time is running out on the two-state solution is really what's animating the possibilities here. This is what's animating that for the administration. And I would add to this that for the administration itself, it is also something that is animating it as a priority, because there's also American public opinion, which I polled recently, asking what would Americans want to support if the two-state solution is no longer on the table. And of those who support a two-state solution, you have two-thirds say they would then support a one-state solution with equal citizenship, two-thirds. And you had 52% of those who identify themselves as pro-Israel say they would then support a one-state solution with equal citizenship. Now, of course, public opinion is fluid. We know that there'll be narrative wars that could lead to change. But no American official can actually support that prospect politically right now. And no American official can support continuation of occupation. And no American official can support unequal citizenship. Because if you conclude that two-state solution is no longer possible, I think American politicians will be paralyzed. They wouldn't know what to do. And that's why I think if there is failure, genuine failure, and the President of the United States woke up in the morning and said, it's too late, two-state solution is not impossible, he'll go to the American people and say two-state solution is still possible, because there is no way of getting around that option. But I think for most of us, including me, I don't think it's I think we could pretend, because I think most people see this, if the two-state solution is not too late for it, most of us see this effort as probably the last chance. And I think that is something that no one wants to deal with, and that is probably the opening that we have, and that's the principal reason why we have an opportunity for something that could resonate with the public. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Shibley, and I want to thank once again all of our panelists for their very astute and clear-eyed analysis of this very complex conflict. I want to take the prerogative of my role as the moderator to throw out a few questions before opening up to the audience. I think I'll start with Shibley. Shibley, I'd like you to respond to Daniel. Do you agree with him that the Palestinians are in a cul-de-sac, that they've done little to leverage conditions to their advantage, and how can they change the narrative? And then I'm just, Daniel, for you, you mentioned the Bibi's position, demanding that the Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state, and the fact that you think that he's deliberately wielding this issue as a deal-breaker. Can you elaborate a little bit more on this issue and its negotiability? And Aaron, you see no conflict-ending agreement right now, but we've all seen what happens when there is no peace process. I guess my question to you is there an alternative to what Kerry is doing? What else could we be doing, or the U.S. be doing, to set the conditions for a future peace? Let's start with Shibley.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of your question, so can you...
Yes, Daniel said that the Palestinians find themselves in a cul-de-sac right now, that they've not sort of leveraged the conditions out there to their advantage, and that the narrative is not understood. How can the Palestinians change their narrative? And maybe just comment on Mahmoud Abbas and how he's handling the situation right now.
Well, first of all, let's start with the fact, objectively, Palestinians are in a very weak position. They're weak in part because, I mean, you have a Palestinian Authority that is actually negotiating under occupation, that even to leave, the territories and come back or interact, I mean, there is a genuine asymmetry of power that is not just something about a failure of using your assets. It is a real unusual situation, actually, where you have we treat it as if it's two states negotiating, when in fact there's a huge asymmetry of power. And then on top of it, you have an extraordinary set of changes that are occurring in the Arab world that is diverting attention from that issue and making it very hard for them to draw on what is generally an Arab depth for the strategic conditions. There's no question that that is the principal reason why they're in a weak position. But having said that, I think, the Palestinians go back and forth in terms of, the critique of Abu Mazen in general is that he put his eggs in the American basket too much. Sometimes they even make that as a self-criticism. Mm-hmm. I think in the current environment, when you look at all the possibilities, in fact, the U.S. is his only actually avenue to reaching an agreement for a variety of reasons. So I don't think that is a major failure. If there is a failure, I think it has to do with something that Daniel said, which is if you look at, so what is the power of the Palestinians globally? What does it derive from? Other than the fact that what they do is consequential for Israel, Israel is important, certainly here in the U.S., and that is the moral question. The legal and moral question. The fact is, we talk about compromises and negotiations, and we blame equally or not equally. But the reality of it is, you have an environment of unacceptable occupation, a moral environment that is not acceptable. You know, Palestinians being under occupation since 1967, people think of it as the only reason it's tolerated is because we say, this is a temporary environment, and therefore, you know, the way to address it is through negotiations, so let's support the negotiations. So this is sort of the justification for peace process. In the meanwhile, the very fact that we're engaged in negotiations in some ways deflects from our moral, concern about what's happening in those negotiations. And the fact of whether Israeli government agrees or doesn't agree to settlements, again, the focus is on the illegality of it. So that is the power. It is not only the power internationally, it's also the power here in the U.S. And I think that I would argue that contrary to this simplistic approach of the world divided of pro-Israel, pro-Arab, pro-this and pro-that, we are all divided within our souls. You know, you can be pro-Israel and a highly moral person, or pro-Arab or highly moral person. You try to reconcile your moral issues and your concerns with the causes that you have. And so in some ways, the two-state solution and the Arab-Israeli negotiation provides that harmony within the self for competing tendencies. You take that out and it reveals in a naked reality where you have to make a choice between what is obviously unacceptable and that which you're committed to. And that's what the tension that we find in the polling. So I think that's the issue that is probably going to come to the forefront if there is a failure of negotiations, regardless of what the Palestinian Authority does or doesn't do.
Thank you, Daniel.
And Jewish state.
Yes.
I think it's okay. Well, actually, why don't you use Aaron's mic?
So I think it's the substance, but especially the context. What Prime Minister Netanyahu has has been doing is to say, it's this constant refrain of 4,000 years of Jewish history, we were here. And he seems to be saying to the Palestinians, sign up to the Old Testament, actually. Is the way that he is framing the recognition of Jewish state that he wants. But most significantly, he is offering this as an exclusively non-reciprocal premise for establishing two states. In this conflict, and one way of looking at it is to say there are 48 issues. There are issues that are foundational to the Arab-Israeli conflict, and 67 issues. Issues that arise as a consequence of the 67 war. I think one can, in large measure, one could have a two-state deal which said, okay, we can deal with the 67 issues, we can deal with the occupation, including in Jerusalem, and in the fullness of time, we will try to reconcile our national narratives. We will undertake, in a context of no longer an occupation, in the context of two states, we will do some kind of effort of truth and reconciliation. Or you can say, let's try and have an end of claims, end of conflict, the whole enchilada, which is what is being attempted. But if one is going to do the latter, then the approach to history and to national narratives has to get beyond the idea that there is one legitimate national narrative, it is a Jewish national narrative, it is a Jewish state, and you bunch of beggars should be happy that we're giving you 22% of this land to play in. That is what is being proposed here I know it sounds such a natural thing. Israel is a Jewish state. Unlike politicians elsewhere in the world, American politicians unproblematically parrot that phrase. And what could be so difficult? If you're serious about ending this as a Palestinian, why would you just not just adopt that terminology? Palestinians are aware at least of their own version of history. And much as we talk about the Palestinian rejection of the partition plan as being the reason that they are still stateless today, Palestinians are aware that when Israel accepted the partition plan, there was a plan. That in the context of accepting the partition plan, if an opportunity arose, the area that was designated for Israel had to be cleared of Palestinians. Because the area designated for the Jewish state would have been almost 50-50 in terms of population. So in a non-reciprocal way, Israel is asking Palestinians to embrace the historic injustice committed to them and their own dispossession. Now, I think that in the context of a historic deal, which I agree with Aaron, could not be further from what is available right now, but in the context of a historic deal, the Palestinians could accept a language that talks about the unique character of the state of Israel, but not as a standalone. Palestinian history would have to be addressed there as well, and the Palestinians would actually have to be getting something. So what is a definite non-starter is the idea that without the Palestinians, I mean, imagine you're a Palestinian leader. I go back to my people. What do I tell them? Okay, guys, I haven't got a border. I haven't got deoccupation. I haven't got sovereignty. I haven't got Jerusalem. But here's the good news. I've negated our history as a people. And yeah, Ari Shavit has this book, which everyone here has fallen in love with. At least one thing he's done in that book is to open the debate on 48. Of course, he tries to open the debate on 48 and close the debate on 2014, because now everything's hunky-dory and can be excused. But nonetheless, he's done an important service in opening the debate on 48. And I just have to take two other things on this. Or one other thing. What is a Jewish state? Israel hasn't called itself the Jewish State of Israel or the Jewish Republic of Israel. Egypt is the Arab Republic of Egypt. There's the Islamic State of Iran. Islamic Republic of Iran, sorry. Now, apparently there's a reason for that. And that's because we can't agree amongst ourselves what it means to be a Jewish state. Is that a Jewish state in the halachic, Jewish law sense of the term? In which Jewish law? Ultra-Orthodox, Orthodox, Reform, Conservative? What do we mean? So really, if we want to make a demand on someone else to recognize this... Anyway.
I'll come back to the point I made earlier, that governing is about choosing. FDR said of Lincoln that Lincoln died a sad man because he couldn't have everything. And this was undeniably the greatest American president we've ever had. So there's no, in my judgment, there's no alternative to the Kerry approach, in large part because the president has determined what he considers to be vital and core American interests and what he hasn't. And there are four core American interests in the Middle East right now. One, you can hear me?
Yeah.
One is protecting the homeland, the organizing principle of any nation's foreign policy. A second is the president's commitment to extricate the United States from the two longest and among the least profitable wars in its history. A third is weaning the United States away from its dependence on Arab hydrocarbons and hydrocarbons generally. And finally, Iran. The other two Middle Eastern issues, in my judgment, are discretionary. It doesn't mean they're not important, but I use the term discretionary in that they are not vital. These four I have identified all relate back to the security, prosperity, and risk aversion to war, which this president has made the primary mandate of his foreign policy. The other two, the discretionary interests, one is how to comport ourselves to the broad array of changes in the Arab world for which we have no answer. I mean, we support an Arab Spring in Egypt, but not in Saudi Arabia. We intercede in Libya, but not in Syria. We would engage with Taliban and some of the worst Iraqi insurgent groups, but not Hamas or Hezbollah, in large part because in the protection of American lives, we can do just about anything. Ideological restraints really don't mean anything. So that's discretionary interest number one, and it shows with respect to our policy. The other is the pursuit of Arab-Israeli peace, which is an important interest to the United States. But if you had to identify for this administration where it falls in the list of priorities, it would not be at the top of the list. So I describe it as discretionary. Therefore, what Kerry is doing, and he's operating, in my judgment, at the outer limits, frankly, of his mandate. He has gotten as far as he has, and I agree with Daniel, in large part because he has been operating within the comfort zone of the prime minister, at least on three of the six issues. One, Jewish state. A second, security arrangements in the Jordan Valley. And third, by implication, no right of return for Palestinians, which is an American position. There's no and it's been an American position for quite some time, and it will remain an American position. There's no question about it. He has offered to the prime minister a way to put Bibi Netanyahu's stamp, idiosyncratic stamp, on this process. Because the prime minister will be able to point to these three realities in a way that none of his predecessors can claim. Good luck trying to find the mention of Jewish state in an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty or an Israeli-Jordanian peace. You will not find it there. Now, there are reasons, and we could talk about the efficacy of this particular position in a negotiation. But, again, on the issue of alternatives, this is what you have. And one additional point about John Kerry. His predecessor could never have fared as well as he is faring He is in the middle of the mix now on just about every consequential issue that this country is involved in abroad. He has the potential to become, the most consequential Secretary of State since Jim Baker. The potential. The reason he is in that position is because the most dominating and controlling foreign policy president since Richard Nixon, Barack Obama, in a first term, who would not delegate to Kerry's predecessor, has no choice now, absolutely no alternative but to provide his Secretary of State with a margin for maneuver, because there are too many headaches out there, too many problems, and the sand is ticking through Obama's hourglass. In a year or so, basically, it may well be over. And second, unlike his predecessor, the arc of John Kerry's political career is descending. It's not rising. And I don't say this with any disrespect to Hillary Clinton, but the combination of Kerry's risk readiness and Obama's imperative to delegate has created an option here for the Secretary of State. And he is trying relentlessly to own one issue that, in fact, would make him a consequential Secretary of State. And by the way, of all of them out there, this is it. It's this one. Iran's too uncertain, too many moving parts. Syria is, frankly, hopeless. The Ukrainian crisis has already given Putin an edge for the foreseeable future, although the long game he may lose. So this is the issue, and therein lies the source of John Kerry's frustration. Were he only the president, I suspect he thinks it sometimes on this issue.
All right, we have 15 minutes left. Let's start with some questions on this side.
I'm June Rogel with New Israel Fund. Aaron, President Obama's handling of the Syrian crisis and most recently, as you mentioned, dealing with Putin on Crimea have projected a message of weakness to people elsewhere in the world. I'm wondering, how do you see that impact on the ability and willingness of both Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas to follow through and accept the framework that Kerry will be presenting, given that it looks like the United States won't always stand behind what it says we will?
Yeah, I don't think the framework is the main game here. And again, I've been predicting, and maybe wrong, that there will be a piece of paper which both sides can somehow identify themselves with that will allow the negotiations to move forward beyond the April deadline, or some formulation that will allow the process to continue. I think, frankly, that the Kerry Initiative is now trapped between two bookends. One is Ukraine, which will continue to distract and suck an enormous amount of energy out of the president, and second is Iran, both of which, I think, present additional constraints. It's unimaginable to me, frankly, that having failed to come up with an effective policy, and I don't blame unfairly or not, to stop the advantage that Vladimir Putin has in proximity and history and will with respect to Crimea, that the President of the United States is going to turn around at a time when he can't fashion an effective policy toward an adversary and bring additional pressure to bear on an American ally. It's almost unimaginable. And Iran feeds into this because the president's primary objective is to secure a comprehensive agreement which will allow him to avoid war and all of the other unpleasantness that it's going to bring. So if I'm right that the peace process and Iran will both, they're on tracks that will converge roughly around the same time, I cannot see this president, whatever he said to Jeffrey Goldberg, and that interview, frankly, is what Obama feels. There's no question about that. He was six in 1967. This is not Bill Clinton or George W. Bush when it comes to dealing with Israel. He lacks the inherent emotional, political, intuitive, connected character that linked both Clinton. I mean, when Clinton writes in his memoirs, "I loved Yitzhak Rabin as I have loved no man," that's an extraordinary statement. And when George W. Bush, as governor, is flying over Israel's narrow waist with then Minister Sharon, he blurts out, "We got driveways in Texas longer than this country is wide." That comment does not, that is not an analytical comment. Barack Obama grew up in a world where being good on Israel was not really that important or necessary. He grew up without the pro-Israeli tropes and narratives and some of the mythology that motivated an entire Jewish community, and more important, the non-Jewish elite in this country, which is the true foundation on which support for Israel resides. He grew up without that. And as a consequence, he is not, Democrats notwithstanding, it doesn't matter. This is not a man who is in love with the idea of Israel. And as a consequence of that fact, he is less able to make allowances for the realities of Israeli behavior. He feels all of this, but he cannot, and in my judgment, will not act on it.
Okay, let's try to get three more questions in. There's a woman in the maroon shirt, the woman in black, and the woman in... So we'll just take these three questions in a row.
My name is Eliana Sacker. I don't think the Kerry plan... I really appreciate all the speakers, and I agree with almost everything they said, and I appreciate that. I don't think the Secretary Kerry or any of you really related to the a major part of the Palestinians who reside in a decoupled area called Gaza. Thank you.
The woman right next to her? Yes, and then the woman right next to her.
Well, my name is Anat Saragusti. I'm the director of B'Tselem USA, an Israeli human rights organization. You spoke about the fact that human rights is not on the table, and I see that it's not part of the public debate, not of the negotiation. On the other hand, I think that most of the motivation of the BDS movement stems from human rights violations. So how likely is it that, you know, U.S. will prioritize human rights issues as, you know, part of the next phase of the peace talks or whatever talks is going to take place?
And you can just hand that to the woman right next to you. Yeah, sorry.
I'm Samira Daniels. I just wanted to pick up on Shibley and Aaron's intersection of you said that the peace process predicated on the acceptance of Netanyahu, or should I say, you know, if Netanyahu, you know, says this, and then things will be like a domino effect. You seem to imply that. So the point that the thing that has been puzzling me is I have been positing that you need multiple negotiating teams, and I don't mean that in a structured sense, but that you have to be negotiating with a variety of people simultaneously, and you know, with a certain kind of coherency. And I'm wondering, is it that you're saying that this one man's approach is bound to fail, and if so, then what are the options that you would propose? You know, and I think I'd like, you know, any of you to address that.
And, you know, let's take the, because I did point to this young woman in the back. Last question, please be brief.
Hi, I'm Tala from the American Task Force on Palestine. I have a question for Daniel. What is Israel's fallback plan if peace talks fail? Do you see that the current Israeli government could unilaterally withdraw from some parts of the West Bank, as suggested by former Ambassador Oren?
All right, so let's start. Shibley, do you want to take the question on Gaza and the question about leadership?
That and Netanyahu both. The Gaza issue, of course, we didn't talk about it because we didn't talk about a lot of detail, but I can just very quickly, when Obama came to office, I had just written a recommendation through the Council on Foreign Relations Project of the new administration saying that it's hard to imagine a final status agreement without bringing Hamas and Fatah together at some point. When I advised Mitchell during his tenure as special envoy, that certainly isn't the position the administration took. The administration took the position that you negotiate with the Palestinian Authority, with Mahmoud Abbas, but there was a sense that at some point you're going to have to bring them, quote, you have to bring them on board, meaning there was a little bit of, strengthening one, at what point do you bring them in, but there was a sense that you have to bring them in. Right now, that's not even on the table, because I think the idea now is a little bit different, which is if you have an agreement, Palestinian Authority signs it, the PLO signs it, you have support for it in the Arab world, you get Arab Palestinians put it for a vote. If it's good, it'll get support. Hamas will be forced to do something about it. But I think that's sort of the idea. But obviously, lots of problem with that. And so we know that Gaza is going to we're not even at that point yet. But that's obviously another complicating factor. Now, with Netanyahu, what I said is not that it's a failed idea. In fact, if anything, I happen to agree that you can't get around him with Israeli public opinion. I mean, the Israeli public opinion, while it's supportive, that support is based on assessment, and the assessment is a function of what the government is going to say or not say. And in a fight with the U.S., it's hard to know how they'll go. So I think the strategy is not a failed one. The problem, of course, is that when you make it as your principal goal of crafting a proposal, then you're most likely to be responsive to him far more than you are and taking a little bit more of the Palestinian position for granted. That's what I worry about, is sort of at some point the ideas that might be crafted may not be automatically acceptable. And obviously they're trying to work with that, but that's what I meant, not so much that it's failed, that there's no way around it. I think in some ways the conclusion is right, because if they're going to get the Israelis to accept something and put on the table, that's what they do. But if they don't, if there's failure, it ties to the issue of human rights. I mean, what does the administration have on the table? The president already suggested in his interviews of late about he can't then stop the international community from being critical of violations of human rights, of violations of international law, and we see that in American public opinion. So that inevitably will surface to the forefront.
Daniel, do you want to take the BDS question and any others?
Yeah, I mean, just a word on Gaza. I think that speaks to, you know, what Aaron said about this is about a paper, not about something that's going to be implemented. So theoretically, Gaza could be treated as a renegade province if a two-state deal was done, until it gets back on board. But we're not there, because this is essentially not real. In real terms, I think Israel, the current Israeli government, is trying to push Gaza onto Egypt. Gaza's an Egyptian problem, and the Egyptians are saying, Gaza's your problem, and mostly it's a problem now for Gazans. No, the Americans will not pursue a human rights approach to this issue if the peace talks stop. But what having a negotiation does is it means that everything else is put aside, because don't talk about settlements, we're negotiating. Don't talk about human rights, we're negotiating. Don't talk about demolitions in Area C, we're negotiating. You don't want to do anything that might upset the negotiations. If you no longer have a negotiation to upset, you may actually upset an upsetting reality that needs to upset. No, Netanyahu doesn't have a fallback unilateral plan, mostly because he doesn't feel he needs a fallback. He has no, it's not like he's in the peace process to implement plan A. which is to make peace and deoccupy and have two states. Oh, God, if I can't do it through negotiations, I better deoccupy unilaterally. He feels no need to move on the status quo. I just want to say that I think Aaron really hit an important point in his description of Obama and how he views Israel. And I think it also, it applies, you framed it generationally. And I think it applies more to than just to Obama. I think the thing that was most significant that Obama said in that Jeffrey Goldberg interview was when he was saying, you know, there comes a point you can't manage this anymore. And then he goes through why, is it permanent occupation, etc. He actually says permanent occupation. And then he says, do you place restrictions on Arab Israelis in ways that run counter to Israel's tradition? Which, of course, is the other part of Jewish state. What are you saying about the 20% of Israeli citizens who are Palestinians? The idea that an American president acknowledges the existence and talks about Arab Israelis, that's not regular discourse either.
Can I just add one point on
human rights
issue?
Just to wrap up for you to answer some of the questions.
Yeah. Consider the reality. And I've supported the president's risk-averse policy on Syria, despite the fact that I think it's a moral, humanitarian, strategic disaster. We have what I would call an amoral policy on Syria, not an immoral one. And it's a critically important distinction to make. Immorality versus amorality. We allow other considerations to influence our policy towards Syria other than ethical, moral, and humanitarian ones. And I would submit to you, many may disagree, that that is a legitimate basis on which to conduct a foreign policy. May not be a terribly satisfying or happy one, but there's legitimacy there. To think that an administration that has presided over a situation in which 140,000 people have been killed, even if 40,000 of them, 50,000, are regime supporters, 9 million people are either now refugees or internally displaced, in a country of 23 million people, that it will take years to recover from the torment and the catastrophe of what's transpired there. To think that allowing this to continue, on one hand, and then the notion that a president, even while he's empathetic and emotionally, and Daniel's 100% right on the Arab-Israeli, Palestinian citizens of Israel issue. For an American president to actually take a position on this discrimination against the citizens of another country, State Department's human rights report has long had this area of sensitivity where it deals with the issue of Israeli Arabs in a separate section. This speaks volumes about Obama's, how much he cares and how he orients him. But to think that he's going to find a way to sanction a close ally over its human rights violations and transgressions with respect to Palestinians, it just doesn't compute.
Well, we could talk endlessly about this endless conflict, but I think we'll give our panelists a break. Please join me in thanking them for this excellent panel.